So welcome, everyone. I'll do my little greeting, which I sometimes do. And greetings. I'm actually in the state of Vermont. And that'll come a little bit into my talk. I traveled yesterday, actually, from California to Vermont. And this will be related to the theme of the theme tonight, as you gathered from what I said earlier, is practicing with fear. And we'll be continuing after the first time that we explored that yesterday. And I noticed a little bit of anxiety. I was surprised that on the airplane and in the airports in San Francisco, and on the plane coming from San Francisco, well over half the people did not have masks on. I was a little surprised by that. And, when I got to the Atlanta airport, like 80 or 90% of the people didn't have masks on. Same with the plane coming out of Atlanta. And half of the flight attendants did not. It was interesting. And I noticed some concern, anxiety that edges into the territory of our topic this evening. And so that's where I am now. And it's interesting also, I was intending last time, a week ago, to focus some on our experience of fear in relationship to the social realm, in relationship to the larger world. That was on Sunday. And of course, on Tuesday, there were the shootings in Texas, right? And so actually what I want to do this evening is to first do some review of what we covered last time. And so I'm gonna have three parts to the talk. The first is to review some of the basics of practicing with fear or anxiety, and I'll bring in some new material. And then secondly, I want to go into more depth on something which I think I did mention last time, which is how fear arises in the awakening process very, very naturally. That as we deepen in practice, fear is a continual visitor in different ways, in different forms, with different types of experiences. And so part of the reason that fear arises is that we're actually going more deeply. And that's very good to know. That's the second part that I'll talk about. And then the third theme will be then looking at fear in the social realm. And, given the amount of time, I'll be brief on each of these. And I look forward to hearing how some of us have practiced in the last week, maybe with in relationship to the shootings, we'll see. So just a kind of review, a good starting point is just to review in our ordinary experience, when is there fear? What sorts of situations? Of course, we may have when we reflect on the question, what am I afraid of? We might look to fear of death. When polls are taken, of course, as I think I mentioned last time, they show that people are generally more afraid of public speaking than of death. That's bigger. And actually, when we look more closely, even at the fear of death, it's actually more the fear of a painful death than of death itself. When people look closely and ask the questions with some clarity. So there are fears of dying. There can be fears of aging, of different kinds of loss. There can be fears of pain or injury, or loss. There can be fear of our own inner experience, fear of our emotions, fear in relationship to particular situations where there might be a risk of maybe losing a relationship or maybe a job or something important, you know, and it can come up. There can be personal fears related to a sense of inadequacy or one's own possibilities of acting unskillfully. You know, there can be fear in relationship to some territory of one's life, maybe where there's a wound or possibly trauma. You know, there can be probably most basically, very commonly, a fear of the unknown. You know, what I've found in my own experience and in working with people is that we generally fear the unknown so much that we don't want to change, even if the current status quo involves pain and suffering. We often prefer the known pain to the unknown, even if it's, you know, presuming that the unknown will bring suffering. So that's very interesting in relationship to pain. And the suggestion that I think I made last time was that there, again, some foundational ways of practicing with fear, you know, developing mindfulness, really studying our fear over and over again, our fears, our anxieties over and over again, bringing in wisdom perspectives, working with heart practices, and finding ways to act skillfully. So with mindfulness, we want particularly to notice, you know, we want to really study the fear so we really know it well. You know, I think last time I had, I don't know if I either talked about it or had the image in my study, I have an image from the Bread and Puppet Theater of a show that they did, and the title of it was The One Who Set Out to Study Fear. So really, really crucial to study fear. And, you know, we can do that when it comes up. Sometimes we can deliberately go into the territory. And I'll talk in a moment about how that has been really crucial in my own practice. And so we can study how fear is in the body, what the different body reactions are, you know, with the different kinds of fear, you know, the different kinds of tension, where we localize tension, some in the stomach, some in the shoulders, different places. We can notice how fear arises in the mind. And I have a fresh, very fresh example that came from my trip, in addition to the, you know, general anxiety I was feeling in relationship to the lack of masking. Although everyone that I sat next to was right next to me was masked. There was one person on each flight. So, but I had another experience, which was quite interesting. I had a late flight, and I tried to get a lot done in the morning before I left. I was especially wanting to water plants and take care of a lot of things. I had two meals to prepare for what if I wanted to prepare my travels. And basically, I left about 15 or 20 minutes later than I had intended. I'd given myself about an hour, and I wanted to arrive about an hour and three quarters before the flight, which seemed pretty safe. Delta's had come 75 minutes before. But I left later because I was taking care of things. And then I saw that my blueberry bush had some blueberries, so I had to pick them. Anyway, this may be a familiar experience. And so I left about 15 or 20 minutes late. I was taking BART and from North Berkeley, and I just missed my BART train by about 30 seconds. So that got me another 15 minutes late. I got on the train, the next train, which wasn't going to San Francisco. Anyway, pretty much after I missed that train, I noticed anxiety in my mind. And I noticed the dynamics, and maybe some of you in your own study noticed something very similar. It was really interesting. It occurred a little while into having my experience of anxiety that this would be good material for the talk. But and so I was noticing continually repetitive thoughts. Some of what I was noticing, I think, are characteristic of fear or anxiety. There was especially, in my case, repetitive thinking. Over and over again, the same thoughts, right? You know, basically, you know, why did I take too long? There was some self-blame. It was happening over and over again. I was wondering, you know, I was noticing my body getting tense. There was some blaming of myself, you know, but it happened a number of times. Why did I do that? That wasn't very smart, and so forth. You know, years of meditation, the same dynamics happen. And it went on for about half an hour. It wasn't too harsh. And at a certain point, you know, and I was being aware of it. At a certain point, something shifted and I calmed down. I had some equanimity. Okay, whatever happens, I think I'll make it. But it calmed down and I had the brilliant idea, let's learn from this experience. So let's take it as learning, right? Rather than, you know, so there was some kind of shift, but there was basically anxious thinking for half an hour. Interesting, right? And I got to study it and watch it. And, but it was continually, you know how that is, wanting everything to be perfect and line up with my desires and my timetable, which of course it did not. And so I got to watch that process, and eventually things went okay at the airport. And I got to the gate about 25 minutes before the takeoff. And I was just there to join the last people boarding the plane. So there it was. There was my interesting experience of fear and anxiety. So I hope that we get to study that. In a moment, I'll talk about some other experiences, but it was interesting to have that occurring. And so just to really keep studying it, know that repetitive thinking and find ways to work with it. You know, difficulty sometimes is that, you know, fear often is in relationship to an external situation, which in my case, you know, was not going to change, right? It was there. So first area is the mindfulness, the seeing. And I think it's really for the sake of just studying it, not so much getting rid of it or changing it. That sometimes can happen, but just really getting really familiar with fear. That's the purpose of the mindfulness. And then secondly, the capacity to bring heart practices. And as we looked last time, loving kindness, originally designed by the Buddha as an antidote to fear. So sometimes when the fear is too much and it's debilitating, we can use loving kindness or other means as an antidote to actually shift out of it. Sometimes it's wise not to be with the present moment, but to shift out of the present moment. That's when it's too much, when the present moment is such that we're stuck and it's too much to be with. And so we can be with, we can work with loving kindness or other tools. Very good way to work with fear or anxiety when it arises there. We can also work with grounding in the body, talking with people, being with beauty. Beauty is an amazing antidote to fear. You know, I remember Michael Mead recommended after 9/11, everyone just regularly spend time with beauty. And then in the traditional teachings, the particular remedy for fear is particularly to do what activates faith, to think about the Buddha, to do the refuges, to read texts, and so forth. The Dalai Lama talks about working with fear by tuning into his good intention. And then So there's all this that we can do, you know, on the level of fear. The second theme I wanted to talk about, which could be a whole focus in itself, is the role of working with fear in the awakening process. And there's something just very powerful about how, as we awaken more fully, there are periods of significant fear that surface as a normal part of the awakening process, that there's some way that we see into some aspect of experience that we didn't previously see. I think I mentioned last time, not positive, that I had this very pretty intense experience about 10 years into my practice of suddenly having enough quiet in my mind where I noticed that I was trying to control experience every moment, that I had basically a fear of the present moment. I did not know that until this experience happened, because it wasn't surfacing. And I actually noticed at a certain level of quiet, I'm scared of the present moment. I want to control it. You know, I want to have it be my way. And so that particular retreat was just hanging out with the fear of the present moment and opening up to it, right? And there also are ways that we can have fear arise with other kinds of experience, that, you know, one of the types of experience pointed out in Zen is called falling into the pit of the void. And this is when we have a kind of insight into emptiness or the kind of the way that nothing is solid. And we have this experience in a deep way before we can integrate it really into our experience. And so there can be a protracted period of fear and anxiety. This, something like this is also identified in Mahasi Sayadaw's Progress of Insight, as he sometimes calls it the, I think in some of the understandings of it, it's called the dark night of the soul, that there is a way in which in the experience that Mahasi Sayadaw identifies, we see into impermanence in a very, very deep way, such that especially we come, this is on the basis of you know, very deep practice, we start seeing impermanence, and particularly the way that nothing stays and the way everything ends, particularly moment-to-moment experience. And this opens one up to a protracted experience of fear that can last for some time. I've had this myself, and I've worked with a few people who've had it. It's particularly a difficult experience when it happens right at the end of a retreat, which it sometimes does. It's a very difficult experience to work with in daily life, because it's better if you stay with the process or maybe go back into retreat and work with it, you know, because it can be a sense of, you know, disorientation. So this is a lot of the experiences related to awakening that involve fear, involve us opening to a new level of understanding, but it's not stabilized yet and not integrated yet. And so it becomes disorienting. We see into radical impermanence. We see into emptiness in a way that's new, very, you know, very experientially based, not a matter of thinking. And this is, I think, related also to a powerful theme of the, you know, what's called the dark night of the soul. You know, that phrase comes from the Catholic monastic Saint John of the Cross, who underwent a very intense experience at that time. He was connected with Teresa of Avila, and they were part of a sort of monastic renewal movement. And they had very contested relationships with some other monasteries. And one of the monasteries actually took Saint John of the Cross and locked him in the dungeon of their monastery for 9 months. right? Anyway, did they ask connections about, is this the spiritually wise thing to do? I'm not sure. But anyway, he went through, it was during this time that he wrote The Dark Night of the Soul. And he just had two main phases, and it was something that occurred, he said, at deeper levels of practice. And I think, and I've taught several times day-longs or several-day retreats on the dark night of the soul, and have worked with people. One person I worked with nearly daily for about 3 or 4 years, going through a dark night of the soul type experience, which then in this person's case involved reactivated trauma that was constantly bringing up fear and difficulty in functioning in some ways in daily life. But it was very clear that it was also part of a spiritual awakening. That's what the dark night of the soul is. St. John of the Cross says that in this experience, there's often a drying up of one's sense of spiritual practice. There can be a sense that everything is dry, nothing is really working. And yet the counsel is you have to stay with this, just as the person I worked had to stay with the process. It was painful, really important to have someone to relate to every day, really, you know, hard to imagine what would have happened otherwise, maybe just a shutting down, don't know. And so St. John of the Cross says that it's like being inside the whale, being like Jonah inside the whale, without any hope of leaving the darkness. Nothing seems to be working, but he said that we have to continually stay with the fear, with the unknowing. He said, the soul, this is Christian language, the soul walks to God through human unknowing, through not knowing what's happening in some way. And I guess one of the ways that I worked with the person I was working with was continually tell this person my own sense of a positive narrative, that this was a purification practice or a purification process. And I think this helped a lot. So, and this is also a very fundamental dynamic in shamanism. I could go into more depth. And shamans often go through something very much like this dark night. And it's interesting that in some ways, one way to look at the nature of fear in the contemporary world, and here I'll go on to the last part of my talk, is to see that we're going collectively through something like a global or collective dark night of the soul. That's one way to frame it, which can give a positive perspective, is that it's a purification process. You know, one person who talks about it in this way is Andrew Harvey. Some of you know his work. He says, for 30 years, I believe three related truths, that the exploding global crisis is, in essence, an evolutionary crisis on whose outcome depends the future of the human race and a great deal of the natural world. That the evolutionary crisis is a mystical crisis with two phases, that of the dark night process and the potential birth that makes possible an embodied divine humanity. That the birthing force of this new humanity, he says, is sacred activism. It's this connection of the deep inner work with responding to the, you know, interlocked crises of our world. And so I think we can see things in that way and look to, you know, again, we can look to the different fears that we have in relationship to the larger world, you know. Fears of violence, right? That it's the fear of violence, especially for anyone who has a child, is greater now after all these shootings. And there's a deep fear of violence. You know, sometimes when I've gone to Canada, I have felt just in my body something relaxing. that, you know, that the level of violence in the United States is, of course, you know, we know that it's way, way greater than it is in virtually all the other industrialized countries. You know, the level of gun violence, it's, you know, I don't know, it's, you know, it's 1/10 or 1/20 per capita what it is in England, for example, right? It's extreme, right? And so there's that fear of violence. I noticed myself, I'm, as many of you know, I'm a regular swimmer, and I go, I've been going because the Berkeley pools are being repaired, as some of you may know. And I've been going to the Albany pool, which is right at the Albany High School. And so there are kids around all the time. And it's interesting. I was, you know, so I swim and I can see the school and I can see the kids are right around. And I have had, I've had thoughts of, oh gosh, there could be copycat shootings, right? That happens, right? How many of you have had some thought like that in your own experience, right? You know, in relation to something maybe nearby. And so we have, of course, for many of us, there's a fear of the loss of democracy, right? That we, you know, that there are many, many signs that democracy is in great jeopardy, you know, and we are unable, we're really largely unable to deal with our larger issues, right? You know, there was a talk or an interview with Al Gore. He made the connection between the inability to deal with gun violence and the inability to deal with climate issues. And this is what he said. Some of the same reasons why the United States has been incapable of responding to these tragedies are the same reasons: lobbying, campaign contributions, the capture of policymaking, the control of politicians with money, lobbyists, that it has been impossible to pass climate legislation. Our democracy has been paralyzed, bought, captured. It has to stop, right? That was his perspective. And again, we can look at the different dimensions of fear to see the way that fear in many ways has been organized, right? And manipulated. Very, you know, one of, you know, some of you know, I've been teaching several retreats on the theme of Buddhist practice and transforming racism. And I've been looking a lot at the history. And one of the insights that I had that I was not so clear about, you know, maybe a year ago, is that when you look to the history and how racism developed in the United States, particularly starting in the 17th century, it's very, very clear that racism is a kind, and hatred is a kind of byproduct, that greed comes first. That's been really interesting. The greed, primarily greed around economic and political power. And that's the, those are the roots. And the actual hatred becomes manufactured, almost generated, manipulated, organized, right, by the people in power, you know, and going right up to the present time through dog whistling. And you know one could interpret a lot of what's happening with voter suppression and so forth as a retrenchment of racism while not using that language, right? Or, you know, I saw that there was, you know, that the manipulation of fear is very clear. Fear of, you know, fear of immigrants, fear of blacks by white workers that they'll take the jobs, fear of immigrants will take the job. I saw even that there was a representative, Representative Paul Gosar, who's fairly right wing from Arizona. He tweeted soon after the shootings in Texas. He said that the shooter was a transsexual leftist illegal alien. That's a congressional representative spreading that obviously false information. That was, he tweeted that after the police in Uvalde had identified the suspect and said he was a resident of the town, right? And given some background on him, but that the shooter was a transsexual, transgender, leftist, illegal alien, right? That's what we're up to. And so maybe just to close, how do we work with this? How do we work with fear in that we have, or that fear that is out there in the social world? You know, how do we manifest what Andrew Harvey was talking about? How do we bring our practice into the world and respond to the situation, to the fear? You know, and I think there's a place for individual practice, really watching the tendency to become numb. How many people have noticed numbness in relation to the events? I think it's very, very common, right? You know, how do we relate to this? How do we enter into, maybe I think look out for grief rituals to come to. I think there's a very important role of group rituals, you know, in teaching on racism. I've done Joanna Macy's Truth Mandala a number of times, which has been really, really vital. You know, and I've experienced it a lot in the, you know, in the 30 or so years I've worked with it, as a way to cut through kind of paralysis or numbness based on fear. So there are practices that one can do, inner practices, group practices. I think there's also a very crucial place for action. Some of you know the, I think it's a well-known phrase from Angelus Arian. She says, action alleviates anxiety. Do you know that phrase? Some of you probably do. Action alleviates anxiety. That's, I think, really, really crucial, that, you know, one way to work with the numbness or the generalized fear and anxiety about our world, which a lot of people have, it's coming up a lot when I do my one-on-one work with people, is to find some, if you don't have it, some way of acting, you know, some way, I think, of, you know, partly finding really, where am I called? It's listening deeply. What is my calling at this time? You know, and maybe we can do some group practices, maybe another day long where we actually work with this, but how can I feel my own personal calling and then find a way of acting, and in a limited way? And I've worked with several people who wanted to act more in the world, and we worked together in this way. I would say, how much time do you have? You know, I remember one person, I've got 5 hours a week. Okay. What issue do you want to work with? And she, I remember, said climate issues. Okay. Research 4 or 5 or 3 or 4 organizations where your 5 hours a week would have a significant impact. Research that and come back in a month. She came back. She had an organization to work with. She's been doing it since, right? That's a simple formula, if that appeals to anyone, right? But I think, you know, finding where one is called and finding how to act in a regular way if you're not already doing so is very, very significant. And responding in one's own community, you know, or, you know, finding solidarity. I remember I wasn't able to do it because I was teaching at the time. But Michael Lerner, Rabbi Michael Lerner from Tikkun, he has close associations with a Black church in Oakland. And he connected with the pastor. And, you know, I think it was a week ago, Saturday, 8 days ago, they organized for people who wanted to show solidarity after the killings in Buffalo to come to that church. And they also had that possible on Zoom. So solidarity, connection, finding one's actions, doing one's own inner work. And you know, and tracking the fear. So let me finish with, this is a real life example of working with fear in a difficult way. This is from actually Dr. Martin Luther King. Some of you may know this story. He went through a real crisis of faith, kind of like a fairly brief dark night experience near the beginning of his work in Montgomery. Remember, he was like a 26-year-old minister, went to Montgomery, you know, grew up in Atlanta in 1955. And he had been receiving a lot of threatening and obscene phone calls. No message machines at that time, 1955. And he had also been in jail. And he came home, actually, very late after a meeting. And his wife and his daughter were asleep. And he got another phone call. And the person used the N-word and said, you know, we are tired of you and your mess now. If you aren't out of the town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house. And for whatever reason, this rattled him. He couldn't sleep. He made himself a cup of coffee and he sat at the kitchen table. This was around midnight. And he was despairing. He felt like he was close to giving up. And how he was strategizing, how could he end his work and not look like a coward? He contemplated the possibility of losing his daughter or losing his wife. And he felt weak. He felt fear. And he knew he couldn't call up his parents who were in Atlanta. And he sat at that table. He said, I bowed down over that cup of coffee. I never will forget it. I prayed a prayer and I prayed out loud that night. I said, Lord, I think I'm here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right. I think the cause we represent is right. But Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. And he stayed with that for a while. It seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying to me, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice, stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even until the end of the world. And he interpreted that as the voice of Jesus. He said, I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still to fight on. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone, never alone. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. And he said that almost at once, his fears began to go. His uncertainty disappeared. And actually, a few days later, his house was bombed. His wife and daughter were in the house. He was at church. And they were not hurt, actually, very, very thankfully. He was given word of the bombing. And he spoke briefly at the podium. His listeners were amazed at the level of steadiness and calm that was there. And he later said about the bombing, his experience with fear a few nights before had given me the strength to face it. So let's end there. Let me end there. And just see what's there for you. Let's take some time now if you want to share an experience that you've had during the week or ask a question, share a reflection. Yeah, just see what's there. Anyone like to share in any way? Could be to, you know, share an experience of working with fear in your practice. You know, I actually didn't mention several times I've worked with fear. At a certain point in my practice, when fear would arise, particularly in a retreat context, I would know, oh, I'm going to learn something. Jack Kornfield has a one-liner. at a certain point, when there's fear, it means, oh, something new is going to be learned. Bowman or Sherry, please.
Yeah, Donald, thanks for this talk. And, you know, what I notice is that, you know, we've had the pandemic. There's just this stuff in Russia, all this violence. And, you know, this morning, I had a great deal of anxiety. Hmm. And I decided to just sit.
Yeah.
You know, and the tears just started to roll. And I recognized that this is just pent up emotion. Hmm. Right. But then I wanted to know, what is it that I'm afraid of? Hmm. And it almost feels like everything. Hmm. You know, everything to some extent. I woke up in the middle of the night a few nights ago and realized that my grandson is 10. Hmm. And has to go to school in Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah.
It scares the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard to identify, like, there's just so much. So how do you work with it when there's, you know, just a constant kind of, whoop, whoop, you know, it's always there.
It's a lot, yeah. So I think, seeing which of the different practices or suggestions I mentioned, I would say definitely bring in regular practices of the heart practices, metta or compassion. In many ways, those can be balancing factors. I think really, really crucial. Being with beauty, do that which is really personally nourishing. You know, I think really, really crucial. Take it as a practice. It's not, you're not doing that to solve the problem of the fear, but you're doing it to balance your being, right? So that the fear isn't the only thing. So it isn't overwhelming. And then I think work with the mindfulness and notice if you're repeating narratives. That's going to be likely, you know, that there's going to be a repetition of narratives, of scary narratives. We can go back to that 2 hours practice, you know, like when something difficult or painful is there, try to avoid, as it were, making it worse with a repetitive narrative. So watching for repetitive narratives is really crucial. And I imagine, you know, you're traveling now, but it's, and I don't know all the details, but finding some way of acting probably would make a difference too. Mm-hmm. Some way that you can, you know, be engaged. You know, maybe you have to settle for, I mean, you're going to settle in California in a little bit and see if there's something that calls you. So I would say, and then be able to air it with other people, not to keep it, see if you can be with groups like this and air it. And I think, again, I should do this, you know, one of the sessions, do a group ritual, or maybe have it be a special session for those interested, because there can be so much that can be released in group practices, and kind of that have the aspects of ritual. So those are a few things.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. But I think how many people can resonate with what Sherry was saying? Yeah, so you're speaking for many. Thank you. Anyone else just like to share maybe something from the last week? Or one of the interesting things is that we can work with smaller fears or anxieties, like, you know, like my example, you know, being, you know, not being as on time as I wanted to be. That was small, that was workable, but the dynamics of the fear are quite similar, particularly in terms of the repetitive narratives, you know. So to look at those. Patty, please.
Thank you, Donald. This may sound naive, and I feel a little naive admitting it, but I find it really helpful to remind myself that what makes headlines is what's unusual. And the more typical person on this planet wants to be peaceful. And yeah. most people in the world want to be wise and peaceful. And so when I try to avoid rereading the news, which is very hard when there's major news like this between the war and climate change and shooting, I keep reminding myself that most people are good And we're only reading about the aberrations. That's why it's news. So I feel naive. I feel a little like Anne Frank, you know, that I still believe in their hearts most people are good.
Yeah.
But it gives me solace when I look at the numbers, that the billions and billions of people who aren't evil and who aren't looking to cause havoc are the vast majority. And I try to find comfort in being a part of them.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful, Patty. And you could, when you speak, I go a few different places with that. One is to, recognize the nature of the mainstream news media. What, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Mm-hmm.
So recognize that, and that could lead to, I've talked about with many people and done myself, trying to be careful with the amount that I take in, mm-hmm. right? What is a good basis? And, the way things can be, it can be something that we just continually take in more and more, way beyond the level of information, because there's some of the algorithms of a lot of the websites and so forth, they're built on more people visiting, so they try to stimulate and so forth, so we know that. So you actually, I found that half an hour of news a day is enough, but I could, we get excitement for, oh, let me just find one more thing, or let me find one more detail about the shooter or whatever. And so being careful about that is part of an implication. And then, I think just remembering that, there's so much, you're really, really connecting with the goodness, I think you could, and there is so much goodness, and, that could be, how do all those many good people, take back things, right?
Mm-hmm. I also found it very helpful. Instead of reading the news first thing in the morning and last thing at night, I read poetry. And poetry really helps me.
Yeah. So it's to keep perspective, and there is a certain level of reality. I mean, there is a war in Ukraine. There is the climate crisis. There is a major threat to democracy. So. Even though, most people, are just want to live their lives in a simple way. And so, that's maybe where we get into the realm of acting for change.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks so much. That's really important. Time for one more, if there is anyone, especially if there's something on the brief side. Hey, anyone else going once? Anyone want to share something? Also, half-baked questions are very good. Don't have to be fully baked. Okay, Mary, please.
This is quick. When you were talking about practices, this is something that happened to me. The whole business of don't know mind.
Yeah.
Because I was really curious, and I always wanted to know. I still do. I want to know. And that sitting with that don't know mine, made me physically ill.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the sick to my stomach, feeling nauseated, was fear-based.
Yeah.
And I found that now it doesn't have that effect anymore, but I had to sit with a lot of really physical discomfort for quite a while. And now there is a sense of ease with that I don't have to know, that I'm not expected to know, that it's okay. And so it was, and I'm talking years of sitting with it. So it's that what you had said about practices has been very true for me. And if I can just bear to be with it, it was very, it kind of worked its way through. So.
Okay. It can open up and after a while, particularly if the fear is in the workable range, we can actually have fear occur and actually say, oh my gosh, something's going to open up. I know I've had that experience after having several retreats where I was, had fear for 10 days in a row or something, or times when I worked with fear, or, another practice that I had was, interpersonally, sometimes I noticed that sometimes with another person or maybe in a group, I would notice myself starting to shake, and I would interpret, I knew there was fear in my system, which meant I had to say what I needed to say. And at a certain point in my own development, every time that happened, I said, I'm going to speak what needs to be spoken. It was actually taking the fear as an opening to further growth.